I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
Today's program is brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery, a Napa Valley winery committed to respecting the soil and dedicated to the creation of three Cabernet blends. For more information, visit cane5.com.
I'm Erica Wides, host of Let's Get Real, the cooking show about finding, preparing, and eating food. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, snacky tunes.
Oh, Welcome to Snacky Tunes. I'm one half your host, Greg Bresnitz. We have Darren calling in from L.A. Welcome, Darren.
Hello. Welcome from the other side of the country.
That was just Kay with her song Honey off of the EP of the same name, who will be performing live in studio later today. Hello, Kay.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. First up, we have Yael Pete. Welcome to Snacky Tunes.
Hi.
Yael is the chef at Karsu. With a great pedigree, but we just want to get one thing out of the way. You don't make sushi.
I don't.
We just want to clear for any people who were curious or wanted to ask that question, here and now just stated, does it need to be brought up again? You don't make sushi.
Not currently.
So one of the things that is really great is that your current cuisine was foreshadowed in your youth from a really strong tradition of Christmas meals at Peter Luger's. What was it like kind of growing up and going to steakhouses, and what was kind of the scene around that from your younger days?
When I was really young, I don't think I understood how special it was. Like, looking back on it, I'm like, oh, man, I'm 9, and I get to eat a $100 steak.
I mean, I'm 34, and if I eat a $100 steak, I'd be pumped.
Yeah, of course. But, like, 9-year-old me didn't know.
Yeah. And what was, you know, what type of memories are, you know, people cook from those memories. How does that kind of come into your current cuisine?
Well, when my mom told me that my steak tasted like a Peter Luger steak, I wanted to cry, basically, because that's a high compliment. But it's also my mom.
So before we get to your current gig, let's kind of go back a little bit. You were an art school student?
Yes.
What was your first kind of passion in the creative world?
Cartoons. Cartoons and illustration. I just grew up thinking my whole life I was going to draw, and then I got to college, and I'm like, I don't really know how this becomes a job. Like, making cartoons on paper becomes a job.
I mean, there's examples out there. So when did the cartooning... Do you still cartoon?
When or I illustrate? Can. When I can. I try my best. But I realized...
So you had this creative bug, this desire to create, and did you see when did you see a path to a career in cooking versus cartooning?
Well, I guess cooking was something I always needed to do because my mom was a single mom. So I felt really, really comfortable with it, and that was the thing that I could see as a career. It's like drawing. Oh, I don't want to sit at a desk for 8 hours a day in a room, and it's cooking. And so I'm on my feet, and I just really like the physical activity of it a lot.
And you grew up in New Jersey, correct?
Yes.
What was your first cooking job? When did you get out of the home kitchen and into your first kitchen?
I went to culinary school when I was 19. So I dropped out of art school. And then I ran away to France, where I cooked for an American family, which was really, really great. I just wanted to see a completely different culture of food. And then when I came home, I started working for Frankie's as a pasta apprentice.
Just to go back to the private chef, did you have to cook American food in France, or did they teach you the ways of the markets and the local food that was there?
She was actually pregnant, and she was a writer, so I was just making her comfortable stuff, and she loved my chicken soup, and she's like, why is your chicken soup so good? I was like, oh, you know, because I get the really good halal chickens from the market, and mm-hmm. I put the head and the feet in it. And she's like, I wish I hadn't asked, because, you know, I take them out, but, like, for the stock flavor, that's got right. All the good stuff.
She's like, I wish I hadn't known. Please keep business as usual.
Yeah.
Can you describe what it felt like to be young and in Paris and going to the markets? And what was that like to walk around, like, hallowed culinary ground?
It was better than even, like, dining out in France. And it was awesome because it was that time, like, right before everyone got smartphones. So I didn't, like, have a phone. I was just right. out there. I mean, I didn't even have a cell phone because I had no friends in France. So I just get up and just wander around the city all alone. And that didn't really freak me out at all. And just all the produce is so much better. Sorry, New York, but it was so, so much better.
I don't think has anyone made the claim that New York produce is better than...
No.
I think that doesn't need to be apologized for. I just think it's
maybe
a given.
Maybe San Francisco versus Paris, but I don't think New York has ever put put their reputation for that.
That's true.
In the ring.
And the markets were just everywhere. Every single block was a market. So it's not like you had to go to the Union Square Market. They were just omnipresent.
Just turn the corner. So once you got to the Frank's Kitchen, what were some of the big takeaways from being a pasta apprentice?
Well, I was telling you that pasta is one of my favorite foods and noodles in general. So that's where I really, really got my footing. I don't know if I can mention names. I mean, I guess why not?
Yeah.
But
yeah, shout him out.
My friend Steven Gonzalez taught me so much, and he was so stern and got me into a really robotic pasta method. But now he makes sfoglini pasta, which I think he's selling at Whole Foods. So
what's sfoglini pasta?
It's a dried pasta company. Hmm. But that's a good place for a cook to end up, to start on the line making $9 an hour, and then to have your own product and company that you believe in. That's pretty much as good as it gets.
And then from there, what is the acknowledgement of being able to graduate from the apprentice program?
Well, it was really just that I wanted to work on the hot line, which means you're making food to order at dinner, whereas I was working in the morning prepping. So I wanted to get into that next level, and that's why I moved on from there.
What was your personal best of amount of pasta made in a morning?
Oh, God. Just disgusting amounts. And I was making a lot of different things. I was doing ravioli and in gnocchi and tagliatelle. So it's a lot of different methods. I mean, but I would have, I don't know, 100 pounds of pasta in a day, my body weight in pasta.
And how much of that would kind of sneak into your bag and you would take?
Well, Frankie's doesn't freeze or dry their pasta. So none. It's it goes bad right away, which I think is kind of a shame. So I actually hand dry my pasta now. So it has a better shelf life.
Hmm. And then from there you went to Montmartre. So how long were you there for?
I wasn't there long because I got on board to be with this chef, Tian Ho. So when he left, I left. And that was weird because I was trying to get into Manhattan dining. And then just suddenly it's we're going to be closed for a week and rebrand. So I was scared. But then I ended up at Prune, which is perfect.
Which is amazing. And kind of the best place where you can learn. I feel like Prune, had they opened in, 2013, would have just, not that they're not a legend in their own right. It would have just been something else. But they somehow both graciously missed and were not part of whatever was going on the last few years.
Oh, yeah. They're just old.
I mean, old, defined.
And so what was it like to work in such a legendary place like Prune? I mean, it was so famous and well-known and such, in many ways, a world-class dining and yet a neighborhood restaurant at the same time. But did you find that approach something that would influence your cooking later on?
Very much so. I mean, I think Prune is my biggest influence, but it's also small. And when a restaurant is that small, your team is small, so you know each other really well, and you really just have to work super, super hard. And as my husband, who's also in the industry, says, you'd drink the Kool-Aid. So it was a girls' club, and it was a little cultish, and it was all who could get there first and do their best. But we had a really, really good time and got really intimate with the food. Is great.
And then from there, moving to Shuko, I mean, when did the Japanese influence begin to creep into your mise en place?
Well, I mean, I guess you could say Shuko and Prune as different as they get.
Yeah.
But they're not. They're not in a way. I've always loved Japanese food and Japanese culture since I was a little kid. And most of the people I know who aren't Japanese, who are making Japanese food, all have similar stories about being obsessed with the cuisine and the culture. We're all just a bunch of nerds. And we all hang out. My best friend works at a sushi place in the Upper East Side, and she's a sushi chef. She's amazing, this girl, Una. And her and me and John Daly and Dave Burana, we all go out, and then we get more Japanese food and then talk about Japanese food. We're nerds.
What is your favorite? Give us your second best kept secret. So the first one remains yours. But second best kept secret for Japanese spot.
Ichiban Te on 14th Street is open till 4 a.m., so that's really good for cooks to go after work.
And what's your favorite thing on the menu?
Oh my god.
Okay, top three. We won't make you choose.
Yeah,
one.
Yeah, because you have to get a couple of things.
Sure.
Taco wasa, which is like raw octopus swimming in wasabi. It's really gooey. And
that
weird.
Sounds amazing.
Maybe wow. Maybe a more beginner thing. Their karage, like fried chicken, is super super juicy.
Forget beginners. We're like this is Snacky Tunes. We go for like the raw weird stuff.
Yeah. Well, also over the summer they have like a really really good cold noodle bowl. Mm. So.
Ooh. That sounds delicious.
So we're going to take a quick musical break, and then we're going to come back and talk about restaurants and chiropractic offices and the menu at Karsu and kind of some knife sharpening skills.
Cool.
This is a track from one of our all-time favorite bands, Avoir Simone, from the first Snacky Tunes comp, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Snacky Tunes. So before we get to Karsu, Let's talk a little bit about Shuko, because I think there's something really significant about your time there and why it was such a big deal that you were working at that restaurant.
Yeah, so I guess I've been reading a lot about myself, which is really weird. It's like what people think about you. You're like, oh, okay. But they're saying like the girl disrupting a sushi scene, and it wasn't like that at all. I was just really happy that they didn't take it into consideration that I was a girl. It's really rare, so that was like kind of how Shuko became such a lucky opportunity. And I've known really, really talented female chefs who couldn't get into Japanese food because of it, just to be frank. And I think that's a real shame. So Shuko gave that to me without ever questioning it. That's very cool.
And do you think that's just a sign of the times?
Yeah, because
not to knock your skills or anything.
It is. And you know, the chefs at Shuko, it's not a secret that they're not Japanese. Their sensei was Japanese, but the two chefs are Korean and Chinese, and that doesn't make them any less of chefs. So naturally it's like the next person they take on won't even be a guy at all.
I mean, it's interesting when you look at Japanese culture, and I think back to something like Iron Chef, when you had these Japanese guys cooking French food, Italian food, things like that, and no one would ever question their background. They were just doing it the best version, especially even today when you go to Japan and you see these types of food that's like, this is the best type of this cuisine, even though it's not from Japan. And I wonder why the flip in America is not yet considered just standard bearer, when some people are like, we're not from that culture, but we're going to cook the best food possible from a culture we love.
I mean, I think when in doubt, especially if you're cooking food that's not from your own culture, it's just to like to be respectful and do a lot of research and, you know, embrace criticism and don't try to tell anyone to do something a certain way if it's not yours and you don't know it. And that's it. You know, that's the best you can do.
And was Shuko what got you into knife sharpening?
I had been knife sharpening since college because I used to work with this woman, Marjorie, who's still in the Chelsea Market on Wednesdays and Saturdays. And she's awesome because...
She's awesome.
I got made fun of at Walmart because my knives were dull. I couldn't cut carpaccio. And they're like, well, why not? And I said, oh, well, my knives aren't very sharp. And they're like, why? How could you say something like that? You can't, like, you should be ashamed. So I went to help her out a bunch. And then, yeah, Shuko definitely changed the game because... I used to say at Shuko, sharpening your knives is like brushing your teeth. If you don't do it every day, everyone's going to notice. I'll cut something, and they're like, I can tell you didn't sharpen your knife today. This looks terrible.
And does the act of sharpening your own knives, is that you're kind of just carve out a space for your own mental reset, getting into the day of the routine?
It's a pain. It requires an amount of patience that most people don't have. So I'd say... like queue up like a playlist. Like I have a knife sharpening playlist, so I know I have to keep going until it's over. Otherwise, I'd stop like every minute.
What's on the playlist?
What's on that playlist?
It depends. I have one called "Girls Just Want to Have Fun." I also have a follow up playlist called "Boys Just Want to Have Fun." It just anything like it has to be like a 10-minute playlist that you can rock out to, and then you know you're done. It's mostly about like making sure you do it for that amount of time.
Mm.
Got it.
So your new spot, what's really great about it is, first off, the location. So how was this place found, and how do you actually get to it?
Well, I knew the Walters guys for a long time, so they reached out to me, not knowing a lot about like the Japanese cooking community. And they were offered this space by their landlord because it was a chiropractor's office, yes. And it was accessed through the residence, through the apartment building. Which, if you've been to Karasu, you know you can't do that anymore to disturb the neighbors.
Right.
So they got a really good deal on it, and the landlord liked them. So we're not a speakeasy, per se, but we ended up with this kind of, like, captain's quarters restaurant because they adopted it. And they were going to make Walters bigger, but they saw it as a great opportunity to have, like, kind of a tucked-away, sexy little bar.
I feel like that's a New York fantasy. It's like, go behind this secret door and here's this hidden, beautiful restaurant. And it just, if you were to take someone there and they didn't know about it, before anything even happened, they would just know they were in for something special.
I personally think we should also bring back the chiropractor, though.
But that's just just for the chef.
After a long meal, getting like your shoulders rubbed for 5 to 10 minutes.
It's on the menu. It's like get back cracked.
Oh, is that dessert or is that part of just part of the meal?
Oh no, that's dessert.
So since we've already established you do not make sushi, your food really is interesting because it is your own personal take on izakaya. And just looking at the menu, it's not something. It's yours. It's very much your own interpretation from, essentially, like you said, Peter Luger steaks are not something you would think that you would find at a Japanese restaurant. Where else have you pulled inspiration from, and how do you make the menu Japanese but equally pulled from your own experience?
Well, you guys were talking about Iron Chef and how they would cook French and Italian, and so deftly. This is a huge kind of 20th century phenomenon because Japan was a closed-off country for a long time. And then there was this like rush and embrace of Western food, and it's called yoshoku. So washoku are the fundamentals of Japanese cooking, and yoshoku just literally means like Western cooking. So I look at that a lot. Like when we nerd out and go to the izakaya, they have mentaiko spaghetti. So I'm not really like rewriting the whole concept. It's just, oh, well, what if we made it with handmade pasta instead of box spaghetti, and you get this ridiculously creamy result. Also prune.
as you've created this menu, and to go back to what you said before about not having people tell you to do it one way when you're cooking, quote-unquote, another culture's cuisine, have you sort of established with the dishes, like the duck chicken wings and things like that, like it's going to be inspired, but we're not going to go traditional, and it's just going to be our own thing?
I would say I try to lean traditional, but I don't really have the right to say authentic. So I've got categories that I want you to see in traditional Japanese cuisine, like a karaage, your fried dish, a rabata, your grilled dish, sashimi and tsunamono, your vinegared vegetables. So I'm looking at pretty traditional cuisine. I just, like I said, I don't want to use the A word. But otherwise, it's, you know, you're going to kind of see these things in a lot of Japanese places, but I'm really, really building them from the ground up. Like, I make my chicken meatballs by hand, where you can just get them frozen. It's pretty easy, but karasu wouldn't be fun if it wasn't for that. It's like, that's what I get to do there.
And it's just you and one other person.
Literally. Her name is Alina. She's there right now, killing it. She's awesome. We're trying to make a sake-based bread right now. She's texting me about flour and talking about Chef's Table, where I don't know if you've seen it.
Yeah, I spent the whole
tear-inducing. It's beautiful, but all the chefs are like, "Oh, you know, it's stale. If you write down the recipe, like we're gonna do it fresh today." I'm like, that never works for me. We mess something up big time, and we're like, "Okay, well, we're not gonna run it today." But
I think that those are watching Chef's Tables and kind of from doing Snacky Tunes. I think everyone has their own method of doing it. I mean, there's the people that profess one way, but I think whatever works best to also provide the best level of service and also not make you want to pull your hair out.
They're also the best chefs in the world.
Yeah, I mean, that's like A++.
Call me in 20 years. I'll be worth talking
to. Oh, that'd be cool. Like, hey, follow-up interview. Are you writing anything down? Still writing stuff down. Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Now, in addition to the food at the restaurant, the drinks are also amazing riff on traditional drinks and things like that. You're working with a great guy who is over at Yuzi Clam Bar.
Yeah, Thomas Wah. You know, it's another place. I gravitate towards small spots, so we all are very, very intimate with each other. And we have meetings before service. I mean, I feel like obviously you kind of have to do that. And, you know, we taste what each other has made, and we're very honest and very embracing, and I love working with him.
And how did you finally arrive at the concept of Kyoto casual? Where did, you know, how did you pick of all the regions of Japan landing there?
I mean, I think Kyoto is kind of known as the emblem of cuisine in Japan. They have a really, really old cuisine. And you're talking about Kyoto dining rooms being set up for kaiseki meals 700 years ago.
Yeah.
Very, very old food. And coming out of Shuko, I was coming off of my kaiseki high. And I would love to do that at karasu, but we don't have the space, literally. And I like letting people come in and have one or two dishes. I don't want to force them into spending hundreds of dollars. So that's, you know, I was still living in my Kyoto Mine when I started there. Like, that's like the Paris where you go to the markets and you see like all the gnarled, beautiful red carrots and the, you know, $80 watermelons, just like very, very cared for cuisine and produce.
I guess with all the new found success and your heritage, the restaurant heritage, you also were nominated and won for Zach at 30 Under 30, which is an awesome honor. And I wonder if, going back to what you said about reading about yourself and those type of press and things like that, does it force you to change about the way that you're thinking of how you're cooking, or just stay the path that has sort of gotten you here?
Well, especially with Japanese cuisine and really what I believe in food, which is it should change because real food changes. It has seasons. I feel always forced to change. And that's why, you know, Alina and I are doing the recipes and failing, because every once in a while we do get something really, really good. And, you know, I've got tomatoes and eggplants on the menu right now, and they have to come off at the end of the month or I'm going to have very bad tomatoes and eggplants. So, yeah, there's a lot of pressure. Keep the menu small is the way to win.
But, you know, I'd rather go to a restaurant that has 10 or 12 of the best things. And I found that when eating in Japan that, you know, restaurants sometimes only had two or three dishes or versions of the same dish. And they just kept refining and refining and refining. And that was the best. And that the bad restaurants were the ones that had 30 or 40 dishes on there.
Last question. What makes a good matzo ball?
Oh, in my opinion, well, schmaltz, like so important, either chicken fat or duck fat, because they won't say that on the Manischewitz box, but like do like half canola oil and animal fat. Very important.
Okay. Well, thanks for joining us. Where can people find you? How can they come eat at the restaurant? Reservations? What is required?
We have Resi. We're very open. And we have a super friendly manager, Courtney, who will pick up the phone for you anytime. Info at KarasuBK, Yael at KarasuBK, KarasuBK Instagram. We're all there.
It's all there. Well, thanks for joining us. Up next, we have Kay live in studio for Snacky Tunes. Kay also moonlights as a band that's been on before called Sand for Men. So we're going to play a track from their previous Snacky Tunes performance called Methuselah, and I'll be right back with Kay.
Pass a message to you when you're a lover. Like a dirty bouquet with your wine. I'll tie to my body some roses. Till I get you alive, are you thinking of me now, Methuselah? I'm a passenger. I go along. Have you found a place that's deeper than the corners of your mind? Settle down. When I'm lost with myself, I see lions. Why?
seamen with their boats in the weather. Carry me as I drift in the night. I don't think of you. Missing you. Are you thinking of me now, Methuselah? I'm a passenger. I go on. Have you found a place that's deeper than the corners of mine?
Welcome back to Snacky Tunes. We have Kay in studio. Thanks for joining.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So I know the opening track we played was very pop 90s influenced. However, I also know that you were in the indie folk scene at University of Michigan.
That's right. You did your homework.
So I want to know what that scene is like and what type of music you were putting out there. And what was the focus of the songs you were writing
oh,
at that
my
time?
Gosh. You don't want to know. Because
I do want to know.
Yeah, I got my start playing at University of Michigan in sort of like the open mic circle. They had open mics in basements of various like student organization halls. And yeah, I just got involved with some really talented and passionate musicians and really encouraged me to keep writing and keep pursuing my own thing. And at the time, it was popping. There's a band called Lightning Love, Chris Bathgate, who still is really active and doing great stuff. I'm trying to think of somebody else. The Electric Six, like lots of bands that are Detroit-based. Alex Winston, she's based in Brooklyn now. Also was a Michigan native. Yeah, and it was just ripe for lots of friendships to be made and lots of inspiration. So
what brought you to New York?
I caravanned out to New York after I graduated from University of Michigan with a bunch of other musician friends of mine.
Like a literal caravan?
It was a literal caravan. It was a U-Haul caravan.
Okay.
So we graduated, and then we put a bunch of stuff in a U-Haul, got our practice space before getting our apartments.
I mean, classic.
Yes.
Classic.
Did you sleep in the practice space?
Oh, of course. Yeah. There were many nights with late rehearsals where we were forced to sleep on a disgusting old couch, but we made it work. And now, unfortunately, we got evicted because it is now a nail salon.
Oh,
sadly.
Of course.
I don't know if I would agree. Of course, I would. If you had said condos, I'd be of course. But the classic turned into a nail salon. I don't know if I would have seen that coming.
I think you're right, actually, because I think the whole building got bought out, and the building part are condos, but the basement where we were is now an Elsalon.
We owned a loft and it's now a J. Crew. So definitely didn't see that coming.
Yeah, definitely not.
So from there, you moved into theatrical electro rock with your first release, Animal Love.
Yes.
So how did it evolve into there, and what was the focus of that record?
So I've always loved theater, and I grew up listening to Broadway soundtracks that my mom and my dad
favorite
would
Broadway
play
show.
The house. Oh man, I don't know. I mean, I think when I first started listening to Broadway, it was like all like the classics, like Les Mis and stuff like that. But yeah, I'm dying to see Hamilton, but I know I'm not going to see it for like 3 or 4 years because it's just not going to. The tickets will open up.
It's easier to probably fly to Chicago and get tickets to Chicago than it is to do it in.
I'm
in
not
New
ruling
York.
It out.
I'm not
out.
Caravan out. Yeah. We'll road trip. We'll
in
sing.
A U-Haul. Yeah.
We'll sing into the woods. It'll be fantastic, and we'll do it.
Yes. Yeah. So I always loved theater, and I made some friends at Michigan who were theater majors. And whether intentionally or not, that sort of influenced the style of this music. And I've always loved big, ornate rock bands and songwriters like Rufus Wainwright. And I think that's part of why I love Sandra Mean so much, is that grandiose element to their music. Sufjan Stevens, too, was a big inspiration at the time. I think that was what I was responding to and putting out.
And as you're moving through the different musical stylings, how are you beginning to identify your own voice and your own story and narrative? Because it seems that you can, as you are a young musician, you can kind of dip in and out of styles, but you yourself remain.
Yeah.
So how are you developed, and what did you hold on to through all the different changes in styles?
I think I've always been very receptive to what has been around me, and I think when I was in Ann Arbor, I was listening to a lot of folk music. I was befriending a lot of folk musicians, and that naturally inspired me, and it inspired me to make songs that were largely written on acoustic guitar. I used strings and lots of organic instruments, and then as I moved into more of like a rock sound, I was still experimenting with strings and stuff like that, but I think the electric guitar was a voice that I had not focused on quite as much until then. And I think as that era has kind of passed, I think the electric guitar has been more of an instrument for me to express myself and to turn to when I have an idea, and I tend to think in melodies for that instrument specifically, whereas before I wouldn't have.
What is it about that instrument in particular that allowed you to open up?
Well, I'm also in a band called Guns N' Hoses, which is an all-girl Led Zeppelin band. No, I'm just kidding. It's an all-girl Guns N' Roses cover band.
And a nail salon.
And a nail salon. We did have many memorable rehearsals in that space.
Okay.
And unfortunately, they'll always live on in that nail salon, whether they know it or not.
Mm-hmm.
So I started playing in that band, and it started out as a party joke. A bunch of girlfriends and I had met through various shows and stuff like that, and they're all front women of their own bands. And we kind of... When it was proposed to me, I was like, I've never played lead electric guitar before, but this sounds like something that I could enjoy, so why not? And it took about a year of practicing and rehearsal with the whole band for us to even sound remotely similar to what Guns N' Roses might have sounded like. But it was such a joyous, like, side project, and in a way, and it let us really let loose on stage while playing this incredibly complicated music, and I didn't sing in that band. I only played guitar. And so that's when I really discovered the power of what, like, a gnarly rock show could actually be when you don't give a single fuck. And you're just doing it for the performance, and there's no pressure because it's a cover band, except for the hardcore Guns N' Roses fans, of course.
And please state your stage name.
My stage name is Gash. It is a female version of Slash, which is already sort of an innuendo in its own way. But the other girls are, so Duff McKagan is Muff McKagan, Izzy Stradlin is Lizzie Stradling, and Stephen Adler is Stephanie Adler.
Just lends itself.
Yeah, it truly did.
Can we hear a song?
Oh, of course.
What are you going to play for us first?
This is a song from the EP that I just put out called Honey. The song is called Armies.
Thank you.
I can't see. Don't tell me I'll just have to wait for the gun. It's gonna go off either way, so I won't wait any longer. Don't tell me I'll just have to wait for your love. I can make you. Can't you see that I flex flying tatters? The colors went and faded back to white. But we're both preparing for one last appearance of the armies in our minds. And now I can't breathe, cause you're all that I need. Don't tell me I just have to wait for the gun. It's gonna go. So I won't wait any longer. Don't tell me I just have to wait for your love. I can make you my enemy, but I won't wait any longer. Tell me I just have to wait. It's gonna go off either way.
You joined Sanferman in 2014.
That's right.
And you had talked about how joining them was kind of in deference to your own work and not really knowing where you were going.
Mm-hmm.
So what were some of the lessons of joining a band that was having a really great moment and had broken through on their second cycle?
Well, I was terrified at first because there had been three amazing singers in my place before. There were the girls from Lucius who sang on the record, and then there was Ray Cassidy who had toured with them before
that. Who
was
in the studio for Snacky Tunes
several
years ago.
And it's so bizarre to hear that iteration of the band before I joined. It feels like this like capsule of time that I was looking into before I joined the band and wondering what I was getting myself into. What was the question?
What are some of the lessons that you learned?
Yes. Well, I think I was just in a period where I wasn't quite sure what the next step of my career was going to be, and I was feeling really lost, for lack of a better word, with not only with my music, but on a personal level. I was like having a really terrible year where like I lost people and was sort of sorting through some interpersonal relationships that had fallen apart, and like feeling really depressed and angry all the time. And that's kind of where Honey was born out of, just a place of anger, but a place of self-discovery as well. And I think I was just in a mode where I was saying yes to everything. And I was kind of, I took like a dance class and I was in Guns N' Roses. And when this opportunity came about, the mutual friend that connected us was like, I don't know if you'd have time for this, but I think it might be an interesting fit. And so I met with Ellis, sang some of the songs, and I really fell in love with the music. And I think that's something that opened me up to the possibility of joining a band where I wasn't creatively invested at the time. Like I didn't write any of the songs. Ellis, even though he is the primary songwriter and arranger, does not sing. And so he brought me on, and Alan is the male voice of San Fermin, and the two of us kind of tell his story in a way. And so I think in sort of letting the pressure that I was putting on myself off, I was able to open up to serving this other project, and serving somebody else's vision really helped me open myself up to why I fell in love with music in the first place, and really helped me hone performing on a different level and only focus on singing as opposed to the whole project. And coming out of the other side of that, now that this EP is released, when I was arranging and writing for all of that, it helped me see it in a completely new light.
And were you able to find time on the road to write the EP, or where did you find the most amount of time?
I actually love writing on the road because there's nothing to do in a van but for 8 hours but sit, and you can either read or listen to music. One summer I watched the entire series of Game of Thrones, But besides that,
well done.
Thank you. But besides that, it's I feel really inspired to write on the road because you're in a different city every day. You're being forced to see the world from a new perspective, quite literally, and that brings about a lot of reflection, I think. And so it's easy to write stream of consciousness in a notebook or on a phone or something, and then make beats in the van and bring ideas together when you have that time. And especially because there's no Wi-Fi, it forces you to be creative without, you know, surfing Facebook or something.
Did you share with the other bandmates, or was it just something totally personal?
Yeah, I would share with Ellis and Alan and anybody else who was interested in hearing it. And I love hearing their feedback. And in San Fermín, everyone, it seems like almost everybody has their own side project. So Alan is releasing his own stuff right now.
We'll have to get him back
really
on.
Cool to see. Yeah,
He's got such a wonderful voice.
He really does.
Can we hear another song?
Sure.
What's the name of this one?
This one is called You. It's the last track of the EP, and we actually just released a music video for this song.
It's incredible.
Oh, thank you.
Where did you find the dancers?
They were just friends of friends. Yeah.
Where did you find the bodysuit?
Actually, this seems like the right place to say it. I got everything that you're seeing in the video, I got at a Halloween store. There's nothing. I didn't spend like any money on the outfits, and the bodysuit that I'm wearing I had had for a few years, and I was like, this seems like the right place to use it. But the cat suits that the dancers are wearing and the like sunglasses and stuff, it's like all from the Halloween store in Fourth Avenue.
Perfect.
Because when you're indie, you have to rig things.
Please take it away.
Sure.
Do you do, do, do it? Oh, oh.
Sonny came out last month. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
How was the show at Mercury Lounge?
It was great. It was really fun.
What's the last month brought since the release of the EP?
It's been great. I've basically just been doing some promo and stuff to release the EP. Hoping to play as much as possible. More on that soon.
Okay. One of the things that's really apparent is that you have a strong producer on that.
I agree.
Elliot Jacobson.
Yeah, yeah.
So how does the conversation between you two exist? I know that you maybe sketch out a melody. Where does his influence and suggestions begin to help form the songs?
I've loved working with Elliot throughout this process. It's been so easy and so fun. I think what really was great about it and kind of very appropriate to our time right now as independent musicians and sort of like the DIY era was that I created all the demos on my own laptop on tour, as we discussed, and then I would basically just send him stems, and he would take those stems, sort of rearrange them, replace some sounds, revamp the drum sounds especially, and then he would send it back to me, and it would be sort of like a back and forth, almost like it was almost entirely digital. Like we only spent one day in the studio, which was to record vocals and some guitars, which we wanted to have outside, like, you know, not in the box, but to create that like live room sound. But yeah, I really admired his work from before, and it's been so easy with him. And I think I'm excited because I think we've really stumbled upon like a really unique sonic blueprint that I'm interested in exploring more in the future.
Were there any tracks in particular where he took things in a totally different direction than when you initially started crafting the music?
Yeah, so there's a song on the EP called Porcelain, which started out as almost like a bad Strokes B-side, and it had like very grungy chords and production that was not particularly inventive, and he took it and totally turned it around into something that I did not expect at all. And he added these trap drums, and the bass turned into this like pulsing electronic thing instead of a live bass, and created these drops. And I remember this one email that he sent me. He was like, it's like a drop, but it's like a Beyonce drop. It's not like an EDM drop. And I think he's good at creating these moments of that are quite special within the songs that I would not have thought of otherwise.
And the 90s influence is pretty apparent. What are some of your favorite acts from that time that continue to influence your music writing today?
Oh, my gosh. It's funny that you say that because I've been playing guitar as a sideman for this band called Bright Light, Bright Light. And he is like the king of 90s music. Every time we get into a car, it's like 90s nonstop. And so we were just obsessing on a recent car ride over Aaliyah, Lauryn Hill, 3LW, Dream, Toni Braxton, like a lot of 90s R&B.
Are you writing this down for your playlist?
I can make it for you. You can send it over. Yeah, and I think Alanis Morissette was a huge one for me.
Oh, I mean, of course.
Yeah.
So what's up for the fall and the 2017?
So San Fermin is recording our third album right now. And it's kind of fun because everybody's releasing their own solo stuff right now. And I was just telling Hector out there that I hope that San Fermin turns into like a broken social scene kind of collective where we have our own projects, but we all can come back and play together and have that we share over the years and have everything kind of developing in tandem and like influencing each other and like lifting each other up.
A good feedback loop.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, we want to make sure we have time for one more song, mm-hmm. But where can people find you, find the EP, find out where you're touring?
So I'm in all the usual places. Instagram is at Charlene Kay, so is Twitter. My website is kayofficial.com, K-A-Y-E, official. And yeah, I think that's everything else branches out from there.
Okay. Well, thanks for being on the show, Yael. Thanks for joining us as well. I know we're going to make some playlists after this for some knife sharpening.
Yeah.
Darren, thanks for calling in. Good to hear your voice.
Yeah, thanks for everyone listening. And please remember that all of our past episodes are podcasted on iTunes. And to subscribe and to, if you have a moment, write a review for us. We would really appreciate it.
Yes, we would. Kay, what is the last song you're going to play for us?
I might do a cover, if that's okay.
Oh, of course it's okay.
This is something that I've never played live, but I've always had in the roster, and I've always loved the song. It's an Aretha Franklin song called Ain't No Way, and figured, why not?
Perfect.
Why not try something out?
Well, thanks for listening. We will be back next week with another episode of Snacky Tunes. Kay, take us out.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me, Greg and Darren, and so nice to meet you, Yael. I can't wait to visit your restaurant.
Talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, Snacky Tunes.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Latham.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.